Hi, Mage of the Podcast fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson. And this week on Mage of the Podcast, I get to have a wonderful conversation with Matt Webb, a partner at Jackalope Entertainment Games. What is the full?
Live Action Studios.
Live Action Studios. They are an official White Wolf licensee. They run LARPs, which are live action roleplay sessions for the World of Darkness. You may have heard of The Night in Question, which was a very large LARP that was done. What was the term that you used to describe it? A premiere or...
A blockbuster LARP is what it's known as, and it's a splatterpunk horror experience starring a set in Vampire the Masquerade, starring the Sabbat, or the bad guys, if you're familiar with that setting.
One type of bad guy, yes. I feel like they're the bad guys in the same way that the Technocracy are the bad guys, but not quite.
Yeah, and the fact they're ultimately right, but the methods are a bit...
Yeah. The two main topics we are going to go over this evening are, one, LARPs, LARPing, and Mage LARP, and two, the ways in which Matt has proposed that the M20 metaplot can be moved forward. These are fascinating topics. You can read more about them at the...
Jackalope-larp.com, but yes.
We will include that in the show notes, along with all the other links. This is going to be a link-heavy show, just to warn listeners. Okay, Matt, what's a LARP?
LARP is short for live-action role-playing, and it is where you move beyond the around the table, and you move in some way, at varying degrees, to physically embody the character you're playing in a physical space. So, at its most fundamental, if you're sitting around a table rolling dice, you are playing tabletop. If you walk into a room dressed as or acting as your character and interact with that room as if you are there, that is a LARP. And in fact, there's a lot of times in tabletop where you kind of have like a mini spontaneous LARP moment where you introduce like a more physical aspect, or two characters are, instead of saying they're holding hands, the two players get up and like hold each other's hands and, you know, actually look into each other's eyes or something. That's kind of, you're getting into the LARP zone, but a LARP is where the entire game is like that, where you're, it's all about being in a space and physically being that person.
Now, there are a bunch of different kinds of LARPs. In my head, it was always people running around in a public park playing rock, paper, scissors and having foam weapons. But apparently there's a wide variety of LARP types. What are some of the ones that the audience may have a chance to participate in, and what in particular does Jackalope Studios do?
So there's the boffer LARP, which is the foam weapons one, because those weapons are called boffers because they're these soft padded like swords and stuff. And those are typically fantasy LARP. They're the kind that are the most infamous right now, where you dress up like a wizard and throw spell packets and that kind of stuff. But still, the idea is you're not saying I'm walking through a dungeon or a field. It's that you're going to a park and you're actually going and fighting some guys dressed as orcs physically.
Nice. So a spell packet, that's like crystal light or something, or is that?
That's like a bean bag that has like trailers on it to make it look like a fireball.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, sometimes it looks goofy, but then again, some of these games look really, really good because they have like professional level makeup and all that. And that's kind of a theme that's going through the LARP universe right now, is that generally the quality and standards are rising as time is going on, as the people aren't starving college students and they're actually able to support the hobby with, you know, day jobs. But the rock, paper, scissors thing is the classic Mind's Eye Theater parlor LARP is what they're called, where there is no physical contact and there's a system that involves rock, paper, scissors for I punch you. Okay, I don't want to be punched. I'm a mean, you know, martial artist, super vampire, and you're a easily crunchy, edible mage. And we do rock, paper, scissors, and if we tie, we compare traits and all this other sorts of stuff. And there's a whole bunch of rules for modifying it. But that was like the original White Wolf World of Darkness LARP was called a parlor LARP, because it could be played in a parlor because it didn't involve swinging foam weapons around. And those are like the two classic American LARPs. Though there's been some really interesting developments in the LARP world over the last decade as we've kind of moved beyond that.
So when you describe that, in my head, it is two players acting things out until they need a system to resolve something, and then they have to do their taxes.
Yeah.
So I know this was wildly popular with Vampire, that you would have LARP nights where like 30 to 50 people would get together, and there were a few...
Still happen. They still happen.
It's mystifying to me. Again, this is... So a friend of mine refuses to get a Domino's reward card because she feels that will be a statement about her she's uncomfortable making, and she insists that every time she goes to Domino's, it will be her last. In the same way that I've never tried cocaine because it's probably amazing, I have never tried LARPing for fear of falling into a LARP hole. And so it is something I will not do out of respect, not out of loathing. Maybe self-loathing, but at the end of the day, I am making no claims except for the fact that people keep doing it. It's gotta be fun.
Well, the thing about like the parlor LARPs, and this is the really interesting thing about it and where it really shines, and we'll probably get into this later when I talk about how we're looking at modifying and moving forward Mage to be LARP friendly, is that you're having a game that involves 30 or 40 people real time pursuing their own individual goals. And when that hits a sweet spot, that's a kind of a magical moment, because it feels like this thing is running on its own. It's alive, and it's not a narrative created by a storyteller. It's a fully functional kind of world you're in, that you're participating in this big shared like fantasy world with a whole bunch of people at once. And it has a life of its own, I think, is the way of best saying, is that it begins to breathe on its own in a way that tabletop struggles to do. It's harder for tabletop to do that, but you're there and you're in some, you know, hotel ballroom with a bunch of people in, you know, suits and trench coats and the usual thing, but it feels like you're in the meeting of a secret society of vampires and there's shit about to go down.
As a storyteller, one of the areas where I feel my storytelling falls flattest is one in the Umbra, just because I can't describe everything. The image in my head is never going to be as vivid, is going to be more vivid than what I can actually transmit to my players, short of becoming a special effects artist. The other place where it falls is large social get-togethers, where ideally, if I were to truly run these characters in this session, and they're getting together with their tradition or their faction or something like that, there would be 15 people, and that just strains my ability as a storyteller. Based on what you described, it seems like, I get that Vampire would be conducive to this, but it seems like Mage might have a problem with it.
They did attempt to translate, and they did the best job they could. In, I think, 2001, they released Laws of the Ascension, which is Laws of the Vampire rules were called Laws of the Night, and the Werewolf rules were called Laws of the Wild. So Laws of Ascension came out in 2001, and they did produce parlor style Mage LARP. And they released a rule book and a companion book the next year, I believe. And they attempted to translate Mage into this traditional parlor LARP. And it was the best possible attempt they could make. That's the best I can say about it. I think they did an admirable job. I think it's an extremely well-written book. I think that the limitations of relying on rock, paper, scissors, and the limitations of just the mentality of the time, and the fact that they're really trying to sell this to vampire LARPers, I think that it produced some artifacts in the way it was written, and I don't think it was ready yet. I think that LARP wasn't ready for it yet, and I think that the concepts of having this crunchy rock, paper, scissors system in order to do Mage wasn't going to work quite right. And they had to make some calls I don't think really made Mage Mage.
It sounds like they were trying to turn vampire LARPers into Mage LARPers rather than turning Mage tabletop players into Mage LARP players. Is that reasonable to say?
I wasn't there at the time, but it certainly reads that way, because their main market was the Vampire the Masquerade clubs, LARP clubs, and their big seller was vampire LARP. So who would you sell to? Try to get Mage people LARPing, or just get the LARPers to LARP something different? It seems like a fairly reasonable call to make.
Now, just to give an example, is there a system that you'd be able to explain to our listeners where they could go, oh, yeah, that seems like it would be real tough to do in person, or being restricted to rock, paper, scissors? And I guess, why did it work so well, seemingly, with Vampire?
So in the Magic system probably was the biggest hit. The rest was okay. But the Magic system, there were so many modifiers to how many traits you had on this number, that number, trying to pull in all the different feels of the Mage system. But they also completely neutered fast casting, where you basically had to track down a storyteller in order to do any fast casting. They very strictly tied sphere levels to rotes. Rotes were basically just this one ability is how it works. It felt like you were just learning spells out of a spell book more than anything,
okay,
rather than expressing your personal paradigm.
Now, when you needed to grab a storyteller, what did the storyteller need to do? Like, why did they have to be present for you to pull a wild effect out your ass?
It's always a conversation with the storyteller, right? To see whether you can do something, right? How many spirit levels do I need to do this? If I want to turn my car into a horse, do I need matter 3, life 4? Or do I need prime because it's a living thing? You know, all this other stuff. And there's always that call by a storyteller of when I'm trying to do something completely out of nowhere, what spheres are required and what the difficulty is. And is this within the local paradigm? Is it vulgar? Is it coincidental? Is those edge cases of whether this is coincidental or not? And this gets even worse if you have two characters who are fighting each other, because, you know, when a character death is on the line, which is usually far more common in a LARP, it gets into even bigger arguments about whether something is allowed or not. So they really clamped down on how much magic could affect things and made it troublesome to do anything out of a very small set of rotes, which basically became your spell book, which isn't a terrible idea on its face, but it really just came off as not having the versatility and vibrance that the mage tabletop game always really sold you on, was that you got to say these mages can do anything if it's within their paradigm, as opposed to I just have this list of effects that I have to do and I have a toy that does them for me.
Now, you're running your own LARP, or you are attempting to run your own LARP, the Eclipse LARP. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what its goals are with you putting that out into the world?
Mage LARP has kind of been a white whale of mine for a while. And one of the things that's been going on in the LARP universe is that there's been two things which have been gaining a lot of steam, which is the freeform movement and the Nordic style / blockbuster style movement, which, you know, we're part of that kind of move. And that has been a move away from the more crunchy, competitive style games and doing things that are more based on immersion, like you feel like you're really in a space, you go to an actual like 1920s speakeasy, if you're playing in a 1920s speakeasy and you play there, you spend a little bit more, but you get a more immersive experience. And also that the game is a little bit more cooperative, so it's a lot more flexible what you're able to do. There's less of an emphasis on you have to have exactly these dots or else it's wrong. It's more, we're going to trust your judgment on what you're going to be able to do as long as it creates a cool story in order to create a more collaborative feel. So that's a big movement that's been going on in the LARP world, which is a departure from the more traditional competitive boffer and parlor style play. Both all these games could coexist with each other, but this is kind of a new kid on the block that's shown up. So Jackalope's been doing that in the vampire realm because, like I said, there's a whole bunch of vampire LARPers out there. And I basically said to White Wolf as a licensee, can I start experimenting with doing not just mage LARP and mage kind of parlor and these Nordic style freeform games, but taking these concepts and moving them into the Maze, the Ascension universe, and trying to update, kind of speculate on what a mage 5th edition would also look like, and trying to take the approach and the kind of neo-noir feel they used in Vampire 5th edition, and kind of revamping and restructuring the mage like meta plot in such a way that it's both more conducive to a larger scale LARP environment, maybe with multiple games going on in different places, and also making it kind of take a more modern feel.
You say updating the metaplot. M20 gave us no metaplot. As in Mage, yes. It was everything for everyone. It was a doorstop love letter to fans.
It was what I'll call the ultimate edition effect. It's like the omnibus edition of a comic book, right? You don't introduce someone to Spider-Man or Batman by dropping them the 200-issue omnibus in front of them and telling them to read it. But if I'm a Spider-Man fan already, I'll eat that. That's what May 20.
Yeah, but the paradox of the omnibus is the only people that want that are people that already know that they're interested in it. So how do you create a system where you can get people in the front door? One of the things that comic books does very well is for those long-running titles, they periodically do a reboot, which makes it easy to get back into, or the first two pages of a long arc will give you, this is what you need to know for this to all make sense. There'll be bonus points if you've read Ghost Rider 17 and Doctor Strange 45 and The Incredible Hulk 191, but we're going to give you the need to know here. Is that something you're trying to incorporate too?
Yeah, I think instead of taking like the ultimate like edition kitchen sink approach, I'm trying to get down to basics. I'm trying to get a foundational, like, this is what Mage really hit its stride on. What's the classic feel updated and kind of taken to the right level of these characters right here matter. Everything is much easier to process. It's a much more focused kind of tone and experience. It comes off as having a very particular flavor, and it focuses on kind of a update. And also, I'm, you know, kicking the tires on certain things. I'm pushing certain things forward. I'm emphasizing things that maybe Phil or Jess wouldn't have, you know, emphasized. And I'm pushing forward things that kind of sing to me because I'm a writer and, you know, that's my right.
You know,
that's how you write.
The tricky part here is White Wolf as an entity is pretty tight-fisted about allowing authors to make core changes to the way the game operates. Like, at this point, a new supplement would not be able to dispense with the notion of avatars, for instance, or get rid of the technocracy, except maybe in an umbral realm or something like that. So there are two parts to it. One is the system, the crunch aspect, and the other is the metaplot or the fluff. How are you changing each of those?
I think that the approach I'm going to take is I'm going to be running events in the Eclipseverse, as it's become to called, which are the negotiated sort of events where you're more given an idea of you are a matter and a entropy mage. These are the general kinds of things you can do. You can negotiate whatever you want with the other people in the scene, and you have a general idea, and there's maybe some very specific things you can do. Like, I might say to a mind mage that they can say, you can walk up to say someone and say, you really, really want to do what I tell you next. And that's like a rule for them. This is just something they can do. That's just relying on the honesty of the players. For a short one-night LARP, that works great. If I wanted to develop, and I'm thinking about developing more of a multi-city sort of like loose network of games, I'm actually thinking about going over and relying on actually mobile apps instead of using rock, paper, scissors, where your character and all your details and your preset rotes and your sphere levels, all that are on your phone. And if you want to do something with your magic or whatever, you just pull it up, you hit cast, you select, you pull in all the options and you throw it, and it tells you how successful you are and how long it takes.
Is that a standalone thing where you're essentially using it as a dice roller plus a character sheet? Or is there something where you and I go face to face with one another and I can somehow verify your information?
If it gets successful enough and there's enough interest in it, I'm a computer programmer by trade. It's really whether or not I can put the sweat equity into it. Jackalope is where I'm licensed through, but this is kind of a passion project for me. Mage has always been my favorite game. So me looking at this, and if there's enough interest and it seems to have legs, I can then turn around and look at White Wolf and say, listen, this thing has legs. Can I, you know, take it a little bit more seriously? And that would start another conversation. And that could lead to the fact that, yeah, you have two mobile phones, they talk to a server, and you run your Kertaman with each other. You know, make it more of a Pokemon Go sort of thing. But that's just a matter of time and effort. And, you know, that's the thing about a computer program. It's like, could it do it? Yeah. Will there be the time and the interest and the energy to make that happen?
I could probably lose a fair amount of weight running around Philadelphia collecting tasks to do node raids on the technocracy. So I'm just putting that out there. So you've mentioned the blockbuster LARPs you've done. Do you have plans to do one for Mage? Or is this the case where you want to build a world and a system where you would like to be able to get to that point? Or are these two things completely different, that you happen to love Mage and LARPing and also run blockbuster LARPs? Are we getting a crossover, Matt?
Well, I'm trying to get to a crossover point. Okay. I'm trying. There's certainly enough interest. If I ran like a short series of Mage games that were set that were like 50 or 60 person mage games that I could charge like $50, $60 for a ticket. Really nice. That kind of price point. I could rent out, like, there's an old speakeasy in downtown Austin. And I've been thinking about, like, just running when they're smaller blockbusters. Blockbusters are usually hundreds of people. Smaller ones are now being called boutique games. If I ran these boutique games, if I ran a 50 or 60 person boutique game, I could rent out these beautiful, like, bare stone brick bars in downtown Austin for, you know, $1,000. And if 50 people wanted to do that, that's not that pricey, actually, per person. So I'd love to take an environment like that and turn it into something cool and interesting and make like a really immersive, tight kind of cooperative mage experience. I've been thinking about doing ones in modern day. I've also been thinking about doing ones in like 1946, not too small a reason being that I just love the old movie Cast a Deadly Spell.
When that hits a success and you want to do a tour of the Eastern Seaboard, just tell me and we can have Mage the Podcast official LARP night at Franklin Mortgage and Trust in Philadelphia, and I will be all over it like a mage on Quintessence.
Well, if you're volunteering to be a location scout, you just did.
Done. We've talked about the LARP aspect of things. Is there any more commentary you'd like to have about Jackalope Studios or LARPing or your rules modifications before we get to what I think is an interesting nut, where you would like to see the meta plot go?
One of the things I really want to do as far as, and in order to make it kind of make something part of the system that's usually very personal and hands-on in a tabletop game, but I want to make like present in the LARP game, is the idea of essence and resonance of the particular mage. And I would really like that, especially if I go with the app direction, what you cast and what you do affects your resonance and shifts it towards a particular direction, so that you can kind of have a cascade effect where you do one thing a lot and that's the thing you do best, but it slowly becomes the only thing you can do because you become that mage. You've started becoming more static or more primordial, or you've gotten too much doth, or any of these other things that kind of stretch you out and make it so that your actions have consequences. Because one of the big themes in mage is that a mage's actions matter in a way that a normal person's doesn't.
It also seems to focus on the idea that when you do magic, you are using magic to change the world, but also that the world changes you. That a mage is a two-way relationship where a lot of reality seems to be a bit more one-way.
And mage is always this, there's always this question of the cost, right? That's what makes the technocracy not the good guys, is the fact that the cost of what they're doing is sinister and high. And whatever their ideals are, the consequences of what it is are perhaps too higher than we should pay.
Or at least higher in the eyes of everyone who doesn't agree with them. In the same way that to a Nefandus, destroying reality seems a small price to be able to come in contact with the ability to either rebuild reality or contact with the true things behind it, or to shed the notion of morality. Everyone thinks they're right.
Exactly. And you can think you're right and you can have success behind your wildest imaginings. And, you know, there's an old Chinese phrase, I believe, that says to destroy someone, first expand their influence. And that is very true in Mage. Like, give people what they want. It is the easiest way to destroy them.
You've outlined that you want to have this more intense synergy and resonance system. For those curious, please listen to our episode on Quiet, which had a lengthy discourse on synergy and resonance and how mages are changed by that, for more information.
And there's one more thing I want to add in that I think would be a lot of fun. Tarot. I really want to take, they have these beautiful images of the old tarot cards. I would love it so that you went into a game drawing a tarot card, and that which tarot card you pulled changed the winds of fate for your character and made things work or not work for you differently. If you draw the tower, you get all sorts of things that mess with your ability to create, but enhance your ability to destroy.
Let's explain that the tarot, the precursor to the modern deck of playing cards, was the 78-card tarot deck. It is notable for having four suits, which in the Mage Tarot lines up with the essences. You have questing pattern, primordial, and dynamic. Each one of those graphically depicts one of the four factions in the Ascension War, whether it be Marauders, Nefandi, Traditions, or Technocrats. And in addition to that, though, you have an additional set of, 22 major arcana cards. And they are of particular importance when using them for the purposes of divination. Mage the Ascension created a custom copy in the 90s, which is actually available on the Storyteller Vault for free. If you are just curious about it and you would like a book on some of the basics of the symbology there, grab it.
Beautiful, full color.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Classic White Wolf mage art.
And there is so much crossover information in there where you're like, oh man, I get what this is from. But I contacted DriveThruRPG saying, hey, on the Storyteller Vault, you have this for free. Can I get 100 decks made as a thank you for people who come onto Mage the Podcast? And the response was, no, but we are going to be coming up with a print-on-demand product in the near future. So if you too, like me, want to see that exist again, hopefully in the near future, that'll be available once DriveThruRPG does more print-on-demand stuff.
And they are making a new one, the French version of M20 as a Kickstarter bonus. Had a brand new M20 tarot deck that they're developing. That is the only reason that I went on and backed a French Kickstarter was to get that deck.
Le deck du tarot. Have you talked with any of the folks at Secrets of the Masquerade? Emma Usel, I'm apologies for mispronouncing your name, did a supplement called the Major Arcana, which allows, before a game of Mage, people to do a drawing of that sort to modify how sphere magic and such works during the session.
Oh, no, I haven't heard of this.
Yeah, spend the $2. The author will hopefully be joining us sometime in the near future.
I have seen her work. I've seen her work. It is beautiful.
Bordeaux by Nights.
The Secrets of the Masquerade group is great, and I'll have to pick that up. I really want it to be like one of the cool ideas I have is like before you go into a game, you draw a card and the little image comes up on the app and it describes the bonuses. But if your essence is a particular way, like you're heavily pattern and you pull a primordial card, the app actually goes, actually, no, and it flips the card to a pattern card. Same suit.
Are you going to also do cards reversed? Tarot is notable for, unlike a normal playing card deck, there is a obvious up and down to it. And drawing the tower versus drawing the fallen tower, as it were, the tower reversed, which is Fallen Tower Las Vegas, has a different meaning for the purposes of divination. Are you going that far where you get one up card and one down card? Or
I would love to do that. I actually read tarot in real life. And in fact, my personal blog is called The Fool Reversed, because the fool is creative energy and beginnings, and the fool reversed signifies creative energies focused in the wrong direction.
I am working on a Storyteller Vault supplement for Philadelphia, which is The Fool Unleashed. And that's my cover art, though, is someone did a Philadelphia-themed tarot where the devil is represented by Gritty. And I look forward to having that come out into the world, but other projects first.
I am working on a Mage Noir. One of the games I want to run as a one-shot LARP is a Mage Noir, is what I'm calling it, which is Mage in 1946, just after World War II, the Humphrey Bogart sort of noir era, and that one's called Under the Fool's Moon.
So we've discussed LARP, LARPing, your work with it, where you'd like to see it go. If people are interested in helping at all or watching it develop, where can they go to follow that work?
If you go to mage.jackalope-larp.com, that has my dev log in it, that has some of my setting changes that I've written up. All of them are, of course, you know, subject to change, and as well as like some of my concept art. And in addition, you'll find a link there under social media to both my Twitter account and to the Facebook group that I have for people who are interested in participating or perhaps getting in on this in their own hometown.
It's interesting. You made mention of the changes that have occurred in Mage across editions. We were discussing that before we went through, and you had mentioned how in Vampire V5, there was a fundamental change in scope and scale, and that you would like to do something similar in what we would call M5. What happened with Vampire, and how do you think something similar, or what would you like to see happen with Mage going forward in that new edition?
So I'm going to predicate this that I am a licensee. I am not in any way authorized to write M5. This is my own private project and speculation.
We cannot call this podcast canon.
No, it is not canon, and I am not in any way authorized, and all these changes are my own personal stuff that I'm simply using to run what might be a growing kind of homebrew network. One of the things that happened in V5, or Vampire 5th Edition, which they just recently relaunched, is they fundamentally shifted away from the big global scale plot lines and the kind of power escalation that you saw in the Vampire line. And they kind of recentered the game on the fundamentals of Vampire. It focuses on the core 7 clans. It focuses on young vampires trying to deal with their own cities and urban environments. it tries to have a very specific, good feel for what was like the core gameplay, the core game loop of Vampire. It pushes like hunger and dealing with a beast up to the front in a way that was not been seen before. And it also makes some meta plot changes in the fact that it gets rid of the global spanning conspiracy the Camarilla, which is still there, but it's far more secretive and actually out of most of the vampire's lives. And it says that, you know, there's something called the Second Inquisition, which is a union of traditional vampire hunters and the national security apparatus that make it, it's actually forbidden for many vampires to use a mobile device or the internet, because there has been such a successful campaign, a Second Inquisition, to destroy vampires that use these devices to track them. So vampires have been forced into the shadows in a big way. So they amped up the fundamental isolation and tension and the kind of alienness that was at the core of Vampire at the very beginning and got back to that in a real way. And they also updated it to make it seem more plausible in a modern world setting, and also to kind of get to where stories about vampires have gotten to now culturally. Less Blade, more kind of neo-noir, sort of neo-noir grittiness rather than crazy comic book.
Vampire comes out. They try and work to prove how alien and strange these people are. Power creep sets in over time. You've got trench coat ninjas that come out. It becomes more popular to be a vampire with high humanity. You're a good guy. You're fighting. There's this global conspiracy trying to keep the young ones down. And then by the time we get to Gehenna, the world is just this giant mishmash. And then, pardon me, Revise comes along, de-emphasizes the trench coat ninja to a certain extent, and kind of makes the game seemingly, again, a fight for the world on the eve of the possible return of the antediluvians. And then we have Vampire 20th, which again is pretty open. We have Beckett's Jihad Diary, which is another giant book of setup. And then we have V5 come out, and all of that is decapitated. We have the antediluvians.
Beckett's Justification Diary is what I call it, because it takes V20 and makes it into V5.
It is good, but
it is Beckett's Justification Diary. I love Matthew Dawkins. It is his Hamlet. I love the man to death. It's a great piece of work, but ultimately it's Beckett's Justification Diary for justifying how we got from V20 to V5.
And the big change there is all the antediluvians are called to the Middle East in a phenomenon known as the Beckoning. The Tremere are decapitated rather spectacularly by a drone strike. The Second Inquisition sets off. And the key thing here that we're discussing is, one, plot changes, and two, why those plot changes were done. So you decapitate a bunch of traditions, you pull all the super powerful people away, and suddenly the game becomes street level again. Now, in Revised Mage, that was notionally the point of the Avatar Storm, the destruction of Dewizitep, the loss of Horizon. So that happened in V5. What happened in Mage, let's call it third edition. So what then happens to you in Mage 5 when there's already been this emphasis at trying to bring things back down more to street level?
I think they went a little bit too far, and they also...
Pardon me, in Mage or in Vampire?
And Maze Revised, I think they went too far. I think they removed the tension at the heart of the setting. At the tension at the heart of the setting was, your choices matter. You're one of the visionaries of the world. You're part of the elite of the world. And your choices are fundamental. And what you believe is important. When they took out Mage Revised and they said banality won, and they made everybody at the same moral level, the kind of dangers of extremes and the dangers of hyper-collectivism and hyper-individualism, which I always saw hyper-individualism being manifested as either the Marauders or the Nafandi, who wanted to remake the world as gods and didn't, you know, care how much they hurt doing that, or the Marauders, who were just so caught up in their own damage that they could not see the effect they were having on others. Then you have the high pattern technocrats who are willing to take the jewels of the world, the mages, and mash them into gray pulp in order to achieve this collective vision. Then you have the traditions who are about trying to find the balance, the questing balance between the chaos of choice, the destruction inherent in, or the ability to destroy that is inherent in the individual, which is in the Nafandi, and the cost of the sublimation of the self in the many, which was symbolized by the technocrats. And that was always the fundamental, to me, the fundamental tension of the story and the setting, and why the traditions were central, because they were the only ones who had any balance between those three points. And when they went and they said banality won, and the technocrats and the traditions are just kind of, and your average technocrat is just trying to figure out how to get along with their day and has less lost contact with everybody, and they no longer presented this omnipresent foe of the many, and all that tension loosened so much, it became just something you couldn't do anything with. From a story standpoint, it just had nothing to say anymore, or what it had to say was much, much less striking.
Mage the Ascension kind of turned into Mage the Survivaling, or Mage the Dealing with Ennuying.
Yeah, and that's not Mage. That might have been a really great theme for something else, but it didn't work right. The rules were fantastic. The rule book was the best rule book I think they ever put out. And I think was really, really striking in how well it got a lot of concepts into it. But the changes they made to the world kind of lost the flavor of it. And that's what White Wolf Games always threw themselves at, is that they really had a tone. They had a flavor. They had a bell that rang when you read them. And I think Mage revised the changes that, you know, I know Sataros has widely criticized them, and I agree with most of the criticisms. I think that it lost its song, and that just needs to be addressed. I'd like to get a Mage that kind of had a central song again.
And you feel like Mage 20 was more of a chorus. It was too much of everything. Like, whatever you wanted to run with, it was the Spotify as opposed to the concert.
I think so, yeah. It is not a unified vision, because it wasn't written as such. It was meant to be Sataros and the rest of the Mage staff writing a love letter back to their fans and giving their fans everything you could possibly want if you're already a fan. But I have the freedom of saying, okay, this is my setting. This is my rock concert. I'm going to move forward it, and I'm going to shake some things up. I'm going to take some things, and I'm going to take my viewpoint and my knowledge, and also some of the trends that we're seeing in the way modern fantasy games are going, and how to give those things kind of a place in the Mage setting, which maybe they haven't had before.
Now, do you use modern fantasy and urban fantasy interchangeably, or are those fundamentally different beasts? This is just me clarifying. Or is it the fantasy genre that just happens to be written now?
I would say modern fantasy and urban fantasy I use interchangeably.
How do you plan on bringing sexy back to Mage, as it were? Like, what are the setting changes, which are usually expressed as either meta plot, which informs a system change. So banality one, the side effect of that is everything is a little bit more vulgar, and mages are paradox producing grump machines, or the gauntlet is hard to cross. What are the sets of world changes, and maybe any system changes, that in your version come about? How do you bring Mage to 2019?
So I think the first part is to bring the magic back, which is you make it so that mages are the things that deal with uncertainty, and they deal with the weirdness of the world, because that's the traditional role of a magician or a wizard or a medicine man, is to encounter the weird, figure it out, and figure out how to deal with it and how to understand it as best as anyone can. I'm kind of starting from a basis in where Revise ended, not taking the Ascension book, but Revise ended with the Horizon Realms have been destroyed, but I'm kind of skipping over a lot of the M20 changes, like the foundation of the new council and all these sorts of things. And I'm kind of moving on behind that. And you'll notice that happened a lot in V5 but they're basically working back a lot of stuff. Like, V5 doesn't make any mention of the Keepers of Eden or any of the things that they added or the revised Black Hand. they kind of just let that all kind of fall aside for the most part. We're taking steps to make it so that Mage is a lot more personal about the here and now, and there's a lot more uncertainty. The biggest change I'm adding, and this is also to make it so I can, individual storytellers who are running their own games in their own cities can justify kind of making up their own stuff as far as weird magical things happening, is the idea that there's these things called gossamers, which are the thin places in the world. And these are kind of like reality zones, except for no one's responsible for them.
Okay, so this is not the same as a shallowing.
It is very similar to a shallowing. They don't, gossamers, no one knows what they are. They've started showing up in the last 10 years or so. And they are places with their own rules. They can be big as a mountain valley, or they can be as small as a school locker in an abandoned high school. But they're some place where the rules of reality have been altered.
Like a Horizon Realm, but on this side of the gauntlet?
In fact, one of the standing theories is that this is a part of a destroyed Horizon Realm that has kind of found its way and latched onto a part of reality.
Or a sector of the digital web, yeah.
Exactly. And they've kind of gotten weird. Like, there are places where people just seem to instinctively avoid them, but they also are sources of power, and the fact that they tend to do things, it's easier to do almost all magic there. But that it tends to get a much more exaggerated reaction when you do it. And they all seem to have their quirks and rules. The examples that we've done in the updates is there's a coal mine in Michigan that will only show you the way out if you whisper a secret into the dark. Or there's an attic in Paris that will show you your past if you give it some of your pain.
Are you familiar with either the series Saga or the God Machine Chronicle?
The God Machine Chronicle, there's a little bit of that in there, that there's these places that are off.
Just to explain to the audience, Chronicles of Darkness is an amazing system, and I just wish it had the oomph and beauty of Mage the Ascension, and in it they have this overarching entity/plot option called the God Machine Chronicle, which is this giant entity that takes advantage of unknown rules of reality to instantiate its will in the world, and it is weird. Capital W, weird. And it is wonderful. I literally have never read the Chronicles of Darkness book, but I own the God Machine Chronicle guide and have just plucked little oddities out of it here and there. Strong recommendation. But the overarching thing is you have this weird mega entity that is changing reality in these weird ways, and things are affected by it strangely. So just an explanation of what that is.
I designed stuff in these games to be levers that you can pull. So a thin place, a gossamer, can be things can come out of gossamers. And in fact, there's a recurring theme is that there's these things that take you. And it kind of takes from urban legends and weirdness and like more of a Clive Barker sort of feel. And the fact that one of the things that is kind of being whispered in Mage society, especially on the street level amongst Hollow Ones and Orphans, is this phrase, beware the sideways men, which are something that is coming out of the gossamers. But at the same time, it's hard to get especially older mages interested in the gossamers. There's also this growing sense that something the mages have done, or that the Ascension War has done, is responsible for the gossamers. And we might not like the answer as to what is causing them and what needs to be done to do it. The technocracy simply sees them as a resource to be strip mined. And that becomes kind of a metaphor for the kinds of things we're seeing in society now, where there seems to be this omnipresent problem, but it is hard to get people to address it. And there's a lot of disagreement on what to address it. This unintended side effect that seems to be on what we're our normal day-to-day activities and interests. And that seems to be a theme which is recurring a lot in the modern world, is the unintended consequences aren't being addressed. And that's one of the things that I'm adding with the gossamers. But it's also a way for an individual mage storyteller or something to say, and now I just want this random thing to show up with its own rules, and I don't have to put it into the cosmology because it's a gossamer creature. It's a mutant. It's a freak. It can come out of anywhere, and it can operate by its own rules. Or, you know, one of my favorite series of all time is The Room, which is about this hotel room that came unplaced in reality in 1967, and every object in it has special powers. Like the straight razor will immediately shatter all glass that is touched against. And those are the kinds of things that can come out of a Gossamer. It's just things that are just weird and surreal. So it's like adding this more surreal element, which has become more common in modern urban fantasy fiction, and gives you the looseness of the Chronicles of Darkness without pulling in the absolute openness of it.
It kind of reminds me of how the digital web was viewed when it came out. It very much had the idea that you had the Book of Chantries and you have Beyond the Gauntlet and Beyond Horizon, which is where the Archmasters and Masters run around and play. And they made a very strong effort to remind readers that Masters aren't really in the digital web. So you can be a medium fish in a small pond, as it were. This sounded like it's kind of the same thing, that you're taking advantage of youth and vigor and curiosity to access a resource or a place, at least, that the Masters don't seem to be dicking around with. Is that the intent?
That could be very much the intent. And the Hollow Ones, I think I call out the Hollow Ones as being specifically very good at getting along with Gossamers, and they're not sure how.
Now, the problem I've always had with the Hollow Ones is every tradition is a combination of factions and sub-traditions, but the Hollow Ones to me always seem particularly jarring. To me, nihilism and romance are kind of opposites of one another, and Trash Magicians is a completely different aspect to the pomp and circumstance of maybe someone who's affecting Victorian manners. Have you made any changes to the Hollow Ones then? Or is there a faction that has particular potence with these Gossamers? Or where'd you take them?
Oh, I took the Hollow Ones and I kind of simplified them, which is kind of a thing with the fifth edition approach, as I'm calling it, is that you don't add a new faction. What you do is you just sweep everything away and you try to get to the heart of them, the heart of whatever you're doing. So with the Hollow Ones, I said that pretty much the most of what you hear about the Hollow Ones were people from the traditions encountering the Hollow Ones 20 years ago when trendy ennui and dressing up like a goth princess was what was in the cracks of pop culture. What the Hollow Ones really are a manifestation of the parts of humanity and the human spirit that refuse to have magic banished from them. They exist as part of the paradigm of the urban legend of the fact that everyone walks a little bit faster past a graveyard at night. The fact that they exist in the cracks of modern stasis. And that's really where they get their power from, is urban legend, pop magic, all the things that the masses believe in enough to have it change who they are. The fact that everyone seems to have a little bit of trepidation about saying Bloody Mary three times in front of a mirror.
How is that different then than the mythic threads that the Verbena are using?
The mythic threads of the Verbena are drawing on a much older tradition of sacrifice and price. They have a much deeper sort of mythic thread. This is far lighter. This is the common mystical background noise of that the humanity seems to keep operating under, and the legends that we keep writing. Hollow Ones will keep their childhood stuffed animals because everyone believes that protects you from monsters, and they'll protect them just as well as the Hermetic Circle will.
Yeah, the comparison that I'm making in my head is you have the new version of the Mercurian Elite as an alternative to the Virtual Adepts, which very much to me felt like the Hermetics moved forward 700 years. Can I say that the Hollow Ones, or at least partially the Verbena, moved forward 700 years?
Yes, I think they are. The Verbena moved forward 70 years, but really what they are is they are where every tradition originally came from, which is the disjointed ideas, which always come down to the basic thing of the hidden exists.
So do you feel in a century the Hollow Ones of necessity will have to become a new tradition? If that is the primordial, if everyone at one point were the Hollow Ones, just with different flavorings, do you feel they will eventually turn into another tradition?
I would say that the Hollow Ones will discard what will become another tradition. It's like the beetles in the dirt. Huh. They eat what later fertilizes trees and forests, but the worms and the beetles are the same. The Hollow Ones will throw over their shoulder the things which will either be absorbed by other traditions or will become something else. But they will have discarded all that and have moved on to the other things that are in it, the other parts of Wonderland. I say the reason they're called the Hollow Ones is that they are a receptacle for the world.
So you present a more unified, or at least more paradigmatically consistent group of Hollow Ones. Are they still a disparate faction, or in your world, are they a tradition?
I think that pretty much all traditions at this point do not have a central structure. There's coordination, certainly. They certainly talk to each other. But I find it hard to believe that their traditions are any more unified than the, say, Christians are right now. There might be individual organizations of them. There might be chantries of them. But the tradition, if you look at the word tradition, it means a common grounding for something. It doesn't mean an organization. They are more like mythic threads themselves. The only really organized tradition would be the Order of Hermes, because their entire thread is discipline and organization. But Celestial Choristers, kind of, but not.
Yeah, I was about to say, just because the whole notion, I mean, they have a curia. In first edition, it always felt to me like traditions were a people, where you had a tradition, lowercase t, that was tied to an ethnic group or a racial group. They had a way that they practiced magic, and it was very stereotyped. Mm-hmm. In second edition and revised, that went to, this is a group with a key practice, and anyone who practices this in this way gets to be part of our club. There may be a ethnic bias.
That's more because certain cultures are biased towards producing certain things, right?
And then we have M20, which I feel is an embodiment of the idea that each group is an idea, and any way you get to that idea is fine. To me, the Hermetics, as you said, are a question of, are you willing to do hard work? If the answer is yes, you will gain power. The Verbena are, do you understand sacrifice and exchange? If the answer is yes, you will gain power. The Sons of Aether are, do you have imagination and are you willing to back it with elbow grease? If so, you will have power. Is that still the case in your world, or do you feel as if the traditions then become something more fundamental in this mythic thread view of things?
I think that's, they come much more mythic thread. I think most of the disparates in this world actually become recognized as simply being traditions, parts of the traditions. Like the traditional Chinese magicians that operate off of magnetism and sacred, you know, rice scrolls, sacred symbols, those are acknowledged, and in fact are acknowledged in some parts of the mage literature as simply being a version of Hermetics. They might go under the name Order of Hermes because that was the most prominent one that came in, and they might have their own name for themselves, but the Hermetic tradition comes from knowledge, language, and systems, and understanding those systems as a focus of your will are the way to power. The Verbena are every culture that practiced transaction and sacrifice. The dream speakers of the Kavadi are all animistic traditions that believe that everything has a spirit that can be negotiated with. So you could have a tribe of Native Americans, which if you analyze their beliefs, I believe the Crow are more like the Verbena in the fact that they, and the Pine Mountain people are more like the Verbena. The Aztecs are more like the Verbena. They would not be dream speakers. They would be part of the Verbena thread. But there are, you know, the Pueblo Indians are definitely dream speakers in the fact that they believe that communication between a medicine man and a spirit is the fundamental way of doing magic. So the idea is that the traditions are kind of a way of categorizing yourself, and they seem to be things which constantly seem to erupt over and over again. But you could have a group of like late Greek Stoics who are actually Akashics because of their emphasis on mind and selfless and tranquility. You could see them and you look at them and you say, they're actually Akashics.
As a fan of Epictetus that also likes kicking things, I can get behind that. Are there any other fundamental changes to the power structure of mage that you proffer? I'm reading a thing on your page, the Adept Civil War.
One of the first things I decided to do was take my favorite tradition and blow them up. One of the biggest shifting events in Mage Eclipse is the Adept Civil War. The Adepts won everything, and then they lost everything. The Hermetics actually refer to them as the modern Icarus because they flew too fast, too high.
So what does that look like in the world then?
So the virtual adepts have split into several factions. Basically, the digital web is no longer a frontier. It no longer has infinite promise. It's flooded with sleepers. It's heavily regulated. The new syndicate-dominated technocracy has secured enough turncoats from the virtual adepts that they waged a very successful assault on a great number of adept-held territories, so much so that the traditional web is mostly technocrat-controlled or sleeper-regulated.
Okay.
The virtual adepts that remain were forced into full retreat and have walled themselves off, making it much harder for them to find new members because they have to be much more defensive. And you have, in fact, a faction which was considered to be a bunch of grumpy old men until this happened, called the Elite. And the Elite believe that they are an anti-sleeper faction of the virtual adepts. They actually believe that, I can read you their declaration, which is wonderfully angry, which is this is how they declared war. It said, "We offered the masses perfection, the grid, eternal in all directions." And what did they do? From infinite knowledge, they created echo chambers of deception and self-congratulation. From endless freedom, they created closed, sterile worlds where they willingly became cattle to be bought and sold. From unbound expression, they made imitations of imitations shared for the most vacuous reasons. They were given paradise, they turned it into garbage. They were given power, they were handed it right back to their masters. We will never forgive them for what they did. This was the final experiment, and it is over. There is no ascension for the many, only for the elite. This is not up for the debate. The web is ours. We are taking it back, and no one should get in our way." And they're actually advocating a mass whiteout of the masses. They want to destroy sleeper access to the digital web.
We are reclaiming the infinite potential that they have squandered. We want it back.
Right. We are willing to reduce the world into the Dark Ages to do it.
Okay.
We are willing to destroy modern communication infrastructure and the basis of the modern economy if it means we get the infinite potential back. And it's a very angry, but I think very real reflection on what some people have seen technology become in the 21st century, where it has become more in service to our masters than into the individual. So it's kind of an expression of that anger. I don't think the elite are right, but I think their emotion, I think a lot of people can identify with the emotion they represent.
And they're coherent, at least.
Yes.
They're understandable. Now, I'm curious, your interpretation of the digital web, is it the successor to Mt. Coff?
I think the digital web is Mt. Coff.
Okay. So do we suddenly have a whole bunch of Batini mages who are taking advantage of this in your world?
Well, the Batini have a whole bunch of their own problems to deal with at this moment. I haven't decided what to do with the Batini, but I really do want to have them show back up, especially in this looser structure where maybe they don't need to remain as hidden. And especially as, you know, the Middle East and the West become more interconnected, I think that it would be perfectly acceptable to see the Ali Patin kind of show up as maybe the advocates for a more unified set of traditions, and maybe as the kind of people who see their way of as creating the communities that are here and now, as opposed to what the Order of Hermes is doing, which is should give everyone pause, though, especially the Verbena, because they might have seen the song and dance before. Because the Order of Hermes has given in to demands that they become more involved. And I don't think most people probably don't understand what that actually involves when you ask the Order of Hermes to get more active.
When you say they have been asked to get more active, are you saying that is in the wake of the Avatar Storm, that is in the wake of M20, that is in your continuity, or something else?
In the wake of the Avatar Storm, in the wake of the Gossamer showing up, in the wake of the renewed pogrom by the technocracy, now called realignment. Under all these things, you have new generations of hermetics and the remaining old ones. And the new generation of hermetics have been raised on media and stories which depict wizards and mages as the people who go and fight the good fight and help people and, you know, use their knowledge of magic to fight magic problems. And the Order of Hermes, the old guard, is used to this very standoffish, studious thing. Well, you have a lot of these newer voices which are saying, no, we have a obligation to, you know, go forth with the hero's journey and to, you know, address, even if we don't reveal ourselves, even if we follow the rule of shade, we should start influencing and fighting the good fight.
In other news, in the 2019 version, the Rule of Shade really needs to be renamed, because every time I hear it, I just think of two mages just shit-talking each other behind each other's back. So your version...
Rule of Shadows, how about that?
Yeah, there we go. That's entirely fine. So in your version, is Ishaq Ibn Thoth still running around as my favorite archmage?
The archmages are not being heard from, because between the Second Inquisition and the realignment squads...
He was the only one around for the Misasa War, and his role in Blood Treachery is like the one redeeming aspect of that book. Hot takes. So in your world, you have the Syndicate Ascendant. Historically in Mage, there has been an inner fight kind of between the New World Order and the Syndicate. In your continuity, was there Nephondic influence? Has it been purged? What is the state of cleanliness, as it were, of the new technocracy? Is Project Invictus still running around? Is John Courage still there?
Well, Project Invictus probably faded into the background. And what's going on in the technocracy is intentionally left kind of uncertain. The technocracy is a world-spanning conspiracy with magic. And even if you are another mage, it can be kind of hard to figure out what's going on there. But one thing that the mages are very sure has gone on is that while the 20th century was mainly dominated by the New World Order, because that was the era of state power, that was where how you got things done was the expression of state power through law and order. In the 21st century, there's been a definite shift for how you get things done is through money and through influence and soft influence and mega corporations and these sorts of things. After the Syndicate's success, completely routing the virtual adepts and turning them against each other, and similarly turning the Celestial Chorus into a joke and so forth, they have become an ascendant influence over the New World Order for the first time in a while. They are mostly just the money mages. The Syndicate and the New World Order's successes inside China have been incredible. Since most of these victories were the Syndicate's doing, they, specifically the Mergers and Acquisitions division, they have kind of gained a lot of influence they previously didn't have. My position on the Nephondic influence is that every single group has to deal with the Nephondic influence except for the Marauders. But one thing I would veer strongly away from is the idea that the technocracy needs Nephondic influence to be what they are. They are scary on their own because the technocracy isn't just technology. The technocracy is collectivism and stasis, where everybody adheres to a master plan, everybody is part of a hierarchy, and everybody operates under the same rules or else. And the technocracy endgame is frightening, not just because it purges magic for the world, but it's a world encased in concrete where everybody has the same 2.5 kits. So I don't think they need the Nephondic influence. And I was always kind of irritated at the implication that they, in order for the technocracy to be evil, they had to have Nephondic influence.
They didn't have to. It just made a particular kind of evil. It made it a more obvious, heavy-handed evil. This is why this ramp of consumerism has gone to extremes and so on. To me, it was an accelerator or an exaggerant. In the same way that the optionality of the traditions taken excess give us marauders. I always felt like the Nephondic influence created this is what happens when certain aspects of this are taken up to 11. Karen Armstrong defined fundamentalism as any faith that substitutes a secondary value for the fundamental object of what that faith is. To me, the Nephondic influence created technocratic fundamentalists, where they replaced their goal with order with the particular goal of either promoting transactions or driving biology to extremes, or computationalizing everything. So to me, the Nephondic influence would always take those inner attributes and take the wrong one and ramp it up. That was my
interpretation. I don't think it needs the help.
It doesn't. Yeah, that's...
Order as a goal is frightening enough. And the moment you have order as a goal in a world that by necessity produces individuals in chaos, the choices that you have to make immediately become scary. This might be just from my reading of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, where it was simply the system itself of like the gulags created the brutality. It was a function of it. It was not a bug, it was a feature. I think that the technocracy's ultimate goal, which is to remove individuals, to remove the influence of individuals in order to make everybody safe. This noble goal in and of itself, taken to its natural conclusion, no matter what the intent is, will produce horrible, horrible things. I think the technocracy is best used, in my interpretation, as a symbol of you do not need to be devil worshipers in order to be evil. You can be absolutely and utterly sincere and still perpetuate a system which is in fact more horrible than anything in the Fondi would think of.
I think we run into problems, though, when we start using the phrase natural conclusion, because to me, what we are saying is comical excess. I think it is the case that most values in actuality have some sort of limiting aspect to them, that they are not trying to ultimately effectuate a single value to an ultimatum, but to come to an equilibrium state. This is kind of outside the domain of it. And when you and I do our Mage Philosophy cast, we should totes get into that.
But I'll turn this around and I'll basically say that what the technocracy's cautionary tale is that you take a individual moral point mm-hmm. and you turn it into a system meant to enforce that moral point that is self-perpetuating and mm-hmm. is not under the control of any one individual, mm-hmm. and you get perversion and monstrosity. And that is the story of the 20th century's attempts to solve things with systems, which I think is a very manifest way to express the technocracy. There are evil individuals who do evil things, and they might have incredible acts of depravity like them, the Fondi. But the reason why the technocracy is the central villain of Mage, not the Nafandi, is that the technocracy, for all of its good intentions, creates massive organized machines to pursue goals that have no soul to save.
We have the notion of a nation state, and philosophically, I like to ask the question, is a country alive? Mm-hmm. It consumes resources, it expels waste, it attempts to perpetuate itself. It has interactions with other organisms, and it seems to show behavior. So I'm going to call that an alive organism, and it starts with a certain fundamental humanism that you have that say that humans are privileged entities, which is fine. But at the same time, you could argue that the traditions are egalitarianism taken to excess because they're steamrolled by this other force. So yes. So now we have this blood bowl of philosophies. And now we have the meta concern of we need to pick a philosophy that allows us to survive other philosophies. Now that becomes a question of, is then the notion of philosophy one where there is a game theoretic aspect to choosing aspects of it that will allow your ideas to perpetuate? But obviously that's not the game we're playing, because right now we are human agents. I would be fascinated to see a version of the technocracy that we're just pushing for the singularity and saying any sacrifice we make now is worth it just because of the absolute explosion of whatever you want that is going to occur once we reach that point.
And we will get the result of every single other philosophy, which said there's a utopia right around the corner. We just need to try harder, which is if you have a business in building crematoria, you're going to do pretty good.
Unless the crematoria are all eaten by gray goo. I just think that nanoparticles are going to take us out. But so the what differentiates that from every time we tried to express quantum phenomena, it has failed. Can we just call the experiment of civilization a scientific process? If the answer is yes, then the argument of there's a discovery right around the corner is going to be a valid fact claim.
True, but that isn't used to justify sacrifice.
Well, that's the point. Excessive is taking a moral stance unto itself. The person who discovered H. pylori by swallowing it and realizing that was the cause of stomach ulcers, before that innovation, that was an excessive risk. Once it was proven to be true, that is no longer an excessive risk. The problem I have is the statement of whether or not it was worth it can only be made in retrospect. I guess there is a science to be said. What are our Bayesian priors in saying, okay, historically, when we have tried to implement a meta-narrative, this is what has happened. And then right. We are in the ironic position of, we have a meta-narrative. We now have a narrative on meta-narratives and how we should behave. So right. I feel as if
it becomes turtles all the way down at that
yes.
point. But I think that one of the things that you can explore, because we're talking about making a story with Mage, right?
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that we explore with fiction is creating narratives that explain our meta-narratives or express ideas, right?
Yeah.
So that we can use those ideas and make them in the reality. So when you talk about the traditions, they're extremely flawed. but ultimately they are egalitarian. They do believe that they're individuals, but they also believe that they're elites. The traditions are based on the idea that there are elites that may or may not have a responsibility and might have varying levels of responsibility to the sleepers, either to ascend the world or to protect them. Or they might think that they just need to go off into a mountain somewhere and pursue their own journey. But ultimately, they're individualists.
Okay, so you've made a bunch of changes to the meta plot. Are there ways in which you feel the V5 meta plot is going to inform what I'm going to call Matt's M5 meta plot? And do you have any advice for storytellers who want to make a big change in their arc and they're just maybe not quite sure how to make that giant change and let that ripple through their game?
So two easily quick answered questions. Okay. the first one with the V5 M5, I did take a bit of the V5 meta plot and fold it into the Eclipse Verse is what we call it, but Matt's M5 is good enough. In V5, one of the big boogeymen are the Second Inquisition, which is a marriage between traditional vampire hunters and the national security apparatus that monitors cell phone signals and the internet and all these other sorts of things. And the Second Inquisition mainly concerns itself with the vampires. But I did write a small blurb on the Second Inquisition, which outlines how they sweep tradition mages and other mages into their nets quite unintentionally.
They see people do weird,
they see people organizing, doing weird things, and they go in expecting a vampire, and they encounter something that isn't a vampire but is weird. And the technocracy, being the New World Order, is manipulating the Second Inquisition very, very carefully, because they really don't want to, you know, anger this particular hornet's nest. But they are bringing in and they're offering specialists to deal with these situations, and been trying to subtly influence the Second Inquisition as being kind of a thug squad for them when they can, and also keeping an eye on what they uncover. What I wrote about them is I like beginning my various write-ups with quotes, and it's from a New World agent saying, "Our new little friends, you feed them a few vampires and they're yours for life." But the reality is the technocracy isn't really concerned with the vampires. They always seen Species 17 as kind of a cat that you can just let take care of itself and isn't going to really mess with the paradigm wars because it's so fixated on remaining secret.
So that's pretty fascinating. You're putting the technocracy, not necessarily at the helm, but the ability to subtly influence the Second Inquisition. So that also answers the question of, are the technocrats being swept up in that? And it sounds like the answer is no.
They're probably getting drawn in more than they really think they are. And they're probably taking more risks than they think they are. Because what happens when they do assert full control over the Second Inquisition and turn it into a thug squad, and the Second Inquisition realizes they're not going after what they came in to go after and they're being manipulated? Will that snake wrap around and bite them? How dangerous a game are they playing? Especially if, say, the New World Order, and this gets into the advice of how do you set up metaplot. What happens if the New World Order really messes up and really gets people, clues these people into what's going on? Those are the kinds of games the New World Order plays. For all their black hats and mirror shades, their true paradigm is politics. Getting into, like, how do you design metaplot changes? Is metaplot changes should not exist just to exist. They should exist to either incorporate changes in the real world. The Adept Civil War is there to accommodate the realities of the internet today and also make it a source of dramatic tension. If you want to play a virtual adept, this now becomes the question you have to talk to. Not convincing people of the beauty of the virtual web, which is a very 90s feel, but grappling with what is the fallout of this project which succeeded beyond our wildest imaginings, which is a tragedy that is a source of a lot of really great drama. The changes to the Hollow Ones is to make them more relevant and to explain why they would continue past the heyday of goth and emo. You're explaining that, no, it's really the traditions misunderstood them. You were just looking at them when they first emerged 20 years ago. They're actually this, and they aren't just penny dreadful mages. That's the purpose of one type of metaplot change, is either to update or kind of blend, fill in the cracks. But also when you do that, you need to give somebody something, the player something to grapple onto as being an idea, like a source of drama and tension. Same thing with the Syndicate Ascendant, is it's there to take the technocracy and put them back in the place of being the villains and make them, you know, relevant and, you know, prescient inside our modern world. So those are good meta plot changes to do. So you're either enabling a type of play, you're smoothing over the cracks, or you're providing a form of tension that you want to explore. And that's the other thing, is that whenever you make a meta plot change, make sure that it brings up a theme that you want to explore, even if it's only a secondary theme. If you don't want to deal with fascism, don't introduce Nazi dinosaurs. Because even though you think people are going to go for the dinosaurs, you still have
they
the
go
Nazis
for the Nazis.
There.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that has been a fascinating walk through where one version of Mage could go. We've dipped into LARP. We've dipped into your metaplot. Matt, thank you so much for your time. Is there a webpage that you haven't mentioned already that we should point our listeners to, or a site or a resource, or is it all just mage.jackalope-larp.com?
Well, also, if you go to jackalope-larp.com, or if you go on Twitter, jackalope-larp, or Jackalope Live Action Studios on Facebook, please like or follow us, and you'll get both updates on this project, other White Wolf projects, and our other side projects, such as we are running Cyberpunk 2020 this May in San Antonio as a immersive LARP experience. So we have a lot of cool things going on just in gaming in general. So please like or follow us on Facebook or Twitter.
Thank you for your time, Matt. For listeners, if this is your first episode, please visit magethepodcast.com. Follow us on Anchor or Spotify or iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. Visit us at Mage the Podcast. Or if you have any thoughts, concerns, questions, ideas, or want to sing our praises, by all means, send us a message at magethepodcast@gmail.com.
Or if you have Correspondence 5, just download it all directly into your brain.
That would require mine.
It's not a mage discussion unless someone corrects someone on a sphere.